Okay, so delighted to be here today with Gioletta Belton. Become somewhat of a friend of mine, friend of the show's, especially through the Big R's movement, spoke at our conference Reforming MSK Practice last year and has kindly contributed to the Manifesto for Reform, which is out soon. Of course, someone that was right on the top of our list for Patient Matters when we decided to launch that as a sub-show, and it's gone really well and people are really enjoying hearing the patient voice, the patient narrative that we're hopefully bringing to life. We're, of course, only following in Gioletta's lead, really, in involving patients more vocally in the CPD space. And so we're delighted to have her on the show to hear her story and also talk a little bit about the journey she's had, not just as a patient, but then also as an advocate that's then involved in the sort of CPD space. And that's how we, of course, went on to meet. So without further ado then, Gioletta, if you can introduce yourself for the listeners.
Sure. And thanks so much for having me, Jack. It's so good to see you again. So my name is Gioletta, and I was a firefighter paramedic when my pain story first started. And that's kind of what led me into this whole space, was just a step off the fire engine that I kind of missed the step, went straight to from cab to ground and felt a twinge in my hip. And that twinge and that misstep kind of led me down this path of ongoing worsening pain that I couldn't make sense of and that I failed all sorts of treatments for, from physical therapy to medications to injections to surgery. I failed them all in the vernacular of healthcare, where we fail treatments and treatments don't fail us. I went through about 3 years of trying to figure out my pain and within the normal healthcare system. And I couldn't find any solutions. Like, things just didn't get better. And I was eventually forced to medically retire from my job as a firefighter paramedic. And at that time, I was at a very low point and wanted to figure out my pain for myself. So I went back to graduate school to study human movement and pain, because I still had very biomechanical notions of what pain was, very structural notions of what pain was. And I thought if I could just fix my movement more or fix my posture more, that I would be able to fix my pain. So went back to graduate school, got my master's degree in human movement, and I studied pain science as my research focus, and that kind of changed everything for me. Challenged a lot of my beliefs, challenged kind of the story that I was telling myself about my pain, what I believed about my pain, and kind of it opened the door onto a different path forward, and things eventually getting better over time.
And so, was there ever a sort of Hollywood aha moment in which you feel that you were sort of had this penny drop where you were into the pain science literature, where it moved you quite quickly from, say, a biomechanical worldview as you had been understanding it to an otherwise more holistic one? Or was it more gradual than that?
It was both. I would have to say that it's both. So when I first started reading the pain science literature, and I was literally just reading articles. I was reading a lot of Lorimer Mosley's work, and I didn't know they had written a book at that time. I was just reading articles. And it made sense to me, you know, the pain science literature, that it's this more like multi-system, multi-factorial response, made sense to me. But I still held on to this belief that this but my pain is real, you know. And by real, I meant I feel my pain in my hip, so there has to be something wrong in my hip. There has to be something structurally wrong in there. Yeah. I said repeatedly in the years after my surgery, I messed up my surgery, because I thought I had been fixed anatomically. You know, my hip looked beautiful after my surgery, that I had to have messed something up in order to still have pain. So I was being exposed to all of this pain science and thinking that, oh yeah, it makes total sense how, you know, stress and all of these other things can play a role in pain, but my pain is real. I had the good fortune of interviewing Lorimer Mosley when I was in school for a project. And it was, I think that was in 2014. So I was towards the end of my schooling, almost 2 years in. So I'd been exposed to this information for a while. And I grilled him for 45 minutes about the science, thinking that my answer was still going to be in there, that there was going to be like this one thing that I just hadn't hit upon yet or hadn't understood enough yet. Sure. And once I figured out that one thing, that I would be able to fix my pain. And at the end of our interview, I asked him what the one thing he would want people with chronic pain to know or to do. And he gave me a sciencey answer at first. He's like, my real answer is to love and be loved. And that was like my jaw-dropping moment where there was just this huge shift in my thinking. It came about for a number of reasons. Just having that conversation with him made me see that I was still valued as a human being, if that makes sense. After all those years of being in traditional care, you kind of start to feel dismissed and punted down the line. You're the difficult patient that people can't help and they don't know what to do with. So they just pass you off to somebody else. Mm. Losing my career was also losing my identity. Before I had this pain, if you were to ask me to describe myself, I would have just said, I'm a firefighter. And to me, that encapsulated everything that I was. You know, I was fit, I was strong, I solved problems for a living, I was a member of a team. There was all these things that came along with being a firefighter that wholly defined me as a person. And then I was no longer that thing. And with losing that career, I also lost my identity. I lost my sense of self-worth. I lost my sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. And I became totally disconnected from so many things in my life. And I really didn't like the person that I was anymore. You know, like I was living this very small, dark, pained, dismal life where I couldn't sit. So that meant no socializing with friends, no driving to the store to pick something up. Like just not being able to sit was incredibly life limiting. So I didn't feel very lovable or very loving at that time that I had this conversation with him. And I didn't necessarily like myself very much, this person I had become because of pain, and wasn't feeling particularly worthy and valuable. By just having that 45-minute long conversation with me, that it itself was a challenge to those beliefs, that I wasn't valuable, that I wasn't worthy. And then him saying to love and be loved just gave me this different perspective on how I was approaching this pain problem, that maybe I could go forward with my life without having pain to be gone before I could do so. That I didn't have to be in this holding pattern above my life, waiting for pain to be fixed before I could get back to living and get back to being me. And it's kind of what made all of the science that I've been learning in the 2 years leading up to that call click and make sense. And allowed me to kind of act on them a little bit differently, that I could start doing some of the things that were meaningful to me, that mattered to me. I could start engaging with the experiences that mattered to me, with the people that I had kind of shunned from my life because I didn't know how to be in pain. I didn't know how to be this person that was in pain. So I shut out family and friends because I didn't want to be someone who needed help or who, you know, brought everybody else down. I didn't want to be a burden on other people. It just gave me this different, it kind of flipped the script a little bit, that I didn't have to wait for pain to be gone to be myself and to engage in things that were meaningful to me, that I could probably be myself and engage in things that were meaningful to me, and maybe that would influence my pain. So it was just a different way of thinking about things.
So with there's obviously a huge amount integral to your story, such as the loss of identity that comes with the inability to then perform your duties with work and the need to leave that role. So there's things that felt like they're almost a, not an inevitability, but certainly something that, independent of the care you received, we could make a case for that really throwing a huge disruption to your life. But obviously I want to talk a little bit about the care during that period as to try and identify any potential positions in which things could have been better, and I know me and you both advocate for better. So I wondered if we could, I nearly called it a highlights reel of the poor care, but obviously it'd be a lowlights reel, wouldn't it? So if you could give us a few clues as to some of the care you received. I know you gave us a bit of a whistle-stop tour at the conference last year, of which there were plenty of squeamishness going on in the crowd of, you know, the real cliches almost that you stepped into. And so could you just give us a clue as to what had been suggested as to be causal in your pain, but also what sort of modalities and treatments you then ended up receiving?
Yeah, and it's interesting because it was all over the place. Excuse me. Initially, so I just felt this twinge in my hip stepping off the fire engine. I had left my clipboard in the ER, so I was getting off the engine to go retrieve my clipboard. I still ran into the ER to get it, so it wasn't like there was some catastrophic injury that took place. And I went back to work. This was a call at like 1:30 in the morning. We went back to the station, went back to sleep, got up for the next call, worked for another 2 weeks before I even saw our occupational doctor, because the twinge didn't go away, and like the twinge kind of became pain in those couple weeks. So I saw our occupational doctor, and I was prescribed muscle relaxants and physical therapy. So started taking the muscle relaxants, started going to physical therapy, was still working full time, my 24, 48, 72 hour shifts. And I wasn't instructed to stop doing anything. So I was still, you know, lifting on my days off. I was still running, still doing all of these things, even with pain. And my physical therapy, my initial physical therapy, I called them like my triathlons. Because all that happened when I went to therapy was I would do the bike for 15 minutes. I would run on the treadmill for 15 minutes. I did the stair climber machine for 15 minutes. And that was it. Those were my 45-minute sessions. And then I was done. And I did that for, I think, 12 visits, something like that. And my pain just was continually getting worse during all this time. And I was reporting that it was getting worse. At that time, it started getting worrisome. Went back to the occupational doctor, and he said, maybe it's just the physical therapist. Let's send you to a different physical therapist. And was sent to a new clinic, but the focus was still on, like, strengthening and stability of the hip, like, or core stability, like these kinds of focuses, which in retrospect doesn't make sense to me now, because at that time in my life, I was the strongest and most fit I have ever been. I was deadlifting, you know, 250 pounds. I could do 12 strict pull-ups, which I know isn't that great, but it was pretty good for yeah, a girl. And that was with no kipping. I could do more with kipping and that kind of stuff. Yeah. But like I was pretty strong at that time. I was a heavy lifter back then. And one of the things I prided myself in was outlifting guys at the station. Sure. So it being a hip weakness issue or a stability issue, when I'm lifting that much weight, in retrospect, didn't make much sense. And probably what I needed at that time was a little bit of rest, because sure. I worked in a physically demanding job, was still working out on my days off. So I worked on that point,
if you don't mind, like, what, because we're talking in using the term in retrospect, but what do you think it was then? Because you know, we look back and it's not coherent with your current state of affairs, really. Under no objective or subjective analysis of that situation could we make a case for it being a stability issue, because the symptoms aren't suggestive of any inherent instability or giving way or anything like that, even if we were to try and force an argument in that direction, we're struggling to. So why do you think it is then that you would have, what was it about the circumstance that made you comply with that, at least initially, do you think?
Well, because I love working out and stuff. Like back then.
So it just fed into your bias?
It just fed into my biases. Sure. I'm like, yeah, well, of course I need to just come work out more or whatever. I mean, at that time I was a gym rat. I would, sure. When I got off shift in the morning, so our shift change was at 8 a.m., but we'd usually do it a little bit earlier. I'd go straight to the gym, and there was times I would spend like 4 hours at the gym. That's how much I loved being at the gym. I was one of those people. Sure. It totally suited all of my biases. Yeah, let's go do some stuff. Let's work out. And that was the case through all of my care. All of the kind of explanations that I was given over time were very biomechanical and structural, which fit in with all of the biases that I had as someone who was a lifter. I was a peer fitness trainer for my department, so I knew everything because I had a bunch of weekend certifications in my personal trainer role.
Right.
So I thought that I knew a lot about pain too, and had all of these notions of pain being, you know, poor posture or poor biomechanics. So working to fix those things kind of made sense to me.
Sure.
But I did start to lose function over time. So towards the end of that 5 months that I continued to work, my function was starting to decrease over time. And it got to the point where I couldn't even step up onto the fire engine anymore with my right leg, leading with my right leg. I had lost so much range of motion probably because of pain. But if I was wearing turnouts, especially, I couldn't even get onto the engine and realize I was becoming a hazard to my crew, a hazard to the public, a hazard to myself, because I couldn't physically do all of the things that I needed to do for my job. And I was starting to get really worried, because the explanations at first were just that it was soft tissue, that it was a soft tissue injury, which also doesn't make sense for the care that I received, but that doesn't, that's neither here nor there.
None of it makes a lot of sense. I think we're going to come back to that phrase to that.
When I went off work at that kind of 5 month mark, it was like 5.5 months, I think. That was a terrible time, because now I'm not going to the station anymore, which I was used to being at the station more than I was used to being at home. Not with my crew anymore. I was used to spending more time with my crew than I was spending time with my husband. And you're working 24 or 48 hour shifts. And sometimes I'd go out of county and wildland fires where I'd be gone for weeks at a time. It was very life upending for us, for me to be home all the time, sure, for my husband and I. And then also I was in the workers' compensation system in the U.S., in California in particular, when this twinge had happened when I was at work. Well, going off work kind of like triggers an investigation into whether or not your claim is legitimate, or if you're just trying to like buck work and not have to go in.
Sure.
During that investigative time, I went 4 months without a single healthcare appointment. So I wasn't even getting bad information. I was getting no information. I wasn't getting any type of reassurance. I wasn't given any kind of explanation for why I was in the amount of pain that I was in. And then, of course, with all of this other stuff going on, the pain got worse. You know, I'm not at work anymore. I'm not doing the things that make me feel like me. I'm not working as a firefighter, which is what my entire identity is tied up in. I'm starting to worry that I might not ever go back to work. And sitting was my worst activity. I couldn't sit. So that meant I couldn't do anything. Like, I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't meet a friend for coffee or a drink. I couldn't drive anywhere. Driving, being in the car was terrible. Driving was more terrible because all that use of my right leg was just intolerably painful at that time. So, and then not talking to anyone in my department, because when you leave as a firefighter, another firefighter just fills your seat. You know, so they're not experiencing the same loss that I was experiencing. There was another Joe in my seat on the engine. It was just a dude, and life goes on as normal for them. So there was all this context around being off too. And my pain was getting worse. After that 4 months, and I saw an orthopedic specialist for 4 months of not receiving care, and he recommended injections. So I had injections by another orthopedic specialist. My pain got worse after the injections. It felt good at the time of the injection and got worse after. So then I was referred to a surgeon, a hip specialist, and he recommended surgery. So I think I saw the surgeon in either November or December of that year. The twinge was felt in January. The surgeon was the first person to give me a diagnosis, like an actual diagnosis. And he diagnosed me with femoral acetabular impingement. He recommended surgery, so I was all on board. Because I'm like, you know, surgery is the ultimate answer. That's the best fix that you can get. I was totally under.
How did you feel about the diagnosis, first and foremost?
It made sense to me. It was nice having something to call it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, it made it more real than just this nebulous pain in my hip and loss of function. Mm-hmm. It made it more real.
It's just a hugely challenging area that remains. So in retrospect, do you feel, because there's this, you know, do we use umbrella terms? Do we use any terms at all? Do we try and make a term as vague as possible so that it's structurally non-specific at all times where we need to? You know, there's all sorts of different sort of schools of thought on this. So I wondered if in hindsight, do you feel that whilst validating at the time, it's now something you wish was never something you were that ever passed the surgeon's lips? Or do you look back and think, no, that was a necessary term that was used at the time?
I don't think it was a necessary term. I wish, so my thoughts now are that I wish we could just legitimize pain without having to have a structural reason for it.
Sure.
The reason that it's reassuring to get a structural explanation for your pain is because it legitimizes it in the eyes of medical professionals, in the eyes of your friends and family, of your employer. It's something that they can then see, so to speak. it's real because there's something wrong with your structure. I wish that we didn't have to have that, that we could legitimize pain and understand that it is very real with very real biological explanations, without having to tie it to structure or specific label. And now, even with what I know about FAI, I don't know that I would have had surgery. I think I definitely had it. And I probably have it in my left hip as well. But I don't think I had to have surgery for it. If I had understood pain differently, if I had understood what we can do about pain that doesn't involve, you know, invasive surgery, I probably would have gone a different route. And I don't think I would have even ended up in his office necessarily had I had a different understanding of pain from the beginning. And the fight for surgery it was 3 months long, you know, like, because it was denied by workers' compensation. I understand that now because there wasn't good evidence to support it. The literature isn't very strong in, you know, recommending surgery for FAI. So I understand it now, but fought like hell to get it.
Especially, and this is what, 6 months on at least?
That was so my surgery happened 13 months after the twinge. So it was a while. And so what's great, so over all of this time and, you know, shedding light on that context too, which also speaks kind of to the continuity of care. I didn't have one person who was overseeing my care with all of this. You know, I went to the two different physical therapists at the beginning. I was seeing the occupational doctor. So now that I say that, there was someone kind of overseeing everything. Maybe he missed some stuff. And then saw the three different orthopedic specialists. By the time I had surgery, because I was weighed and everything for surgery, I had lost nearly 30 pounds, which I don't know what that is in UK terms, but it was a lot. And I didn't have that much to lose because I was very fit and, you know, low body fat percentage. So I was 110 pounds at the time of my surgery, which is what I had weighed when I was in fourth grade. My mom had went through my medical records. I had not weighed that since I was in fourth grade, and my body fat percentage was around 7%. That is alarming. Like, if you had known me before and then saw me in that state, you would be alarmed. But none of the care providers were alarmed by any of that. And to me, that's like a huge flag. Like, there's some bad stuff going on here. After my surgery, when I went back to work, I did go back to work in a civilian position. First, I was on light duty, and then I transitioned into a civilian position when I couldn't go back to work as a firefighter. And I was in our wellness and fitness office. I had worked through wellness and fitness as a peer fitness trainer prior to all of this, so it was an easy transition. One of my responsibilities for that was working with our firefighter academies for their PT, like designing their PT programs and things like that. So having to work with the academy coordinator and the cadre. The academy coordinator was a captain that I had worked with before. He had to sit down the cadre, who all knew me when I was a firefighter, to tell them to modulate their expressions when I walked in the room because my appearance was going to shock them. I'm going to get all choked up because I looked so different. Like, I went from being this strong, fit, you know, firefighter, this kind of self-proclaimed badass who took pride in being a badass, to being this small, frail, weak person who was not me at all. And the guys, I mean, they were shocked. They thought I was dying. They thought that like a diagnosis had been missed and that I had something really, really wrong with me to look the way that I did. And so this is just my firefighter buddies. None of the healthcare professionals thought any of this was alarming, you know? And in my paperwork, it says things like pleasantly thin female. Like, the hell is that? You know, like, no. Like, I was scarily thin, terrifyingly thin.
Yeah.
I don't know how I got off on that tangent, but there's just so much. There's just so much when it comes to being in this pain experience and being so far removed from all of the things that make you feel like yourself. And none of those things were ever addressed in my care. Even the not being able to sit, which I brought up at every single opportunity because it was the most life-limiting aspect of my pain, and it was never addressed.
So there were no strategies being employed to try and make a difference to that specific goal then? It was always fitness. At this point in time, you're describing sort of fitness-centric, exercise-centric care that was all to do with the, you know, exercise to pursue strength, flexibility, and general fitness goals in order to overcome things. But there wasn't anything goal specific to what was relevant to you, which was actually rest, seated rest.
Just being able to relax would have been huge. So I stood all my waking hours. I either stood or I was lying flat on the ground. Those are my two positions of relative comfort. So I spent a lot of time in our kitchen because I just put everything on the counter and would stand in our kitchen. And so after my surgery, so I was 110 pounds. And this is, it's almost embarrassing to talk about. I was terrified of getting fat, terrified. So I became super controlling because I wasn't working out as much, became super controlling around food and all of these things too. And know now that's probably because it was the only aspect of my life that I could control. So I ate super clean and I was measuring like my grams of protein and all my micronutrients. Like I was measuring everything to the nth degree and still working out. So after my surgery, so during this whole time when I was 110 pounds and looking small, frail, and weak, I was still working out. 7% body fat, because that's what I need is to work out more. So I can't sit. So at the, and during PT, it's all about restoring my range of motion and getting my strength back. And so even though I was small, I was still pretty strong. And I was doing step ups to the treatment table, you know, to mimic getting on the back of the fire engine. It was even higher than the back of the fire engine. I was doing weighted walking lunges. I was doing TRX triple threats, like this TRX system, you know, leg workout that is just brutal. Loved all of this stuff because I loved working out. It was part of, you know, who I was before all this. Did all of this through pain. My pain was never changing. My biggest concern was not being able to sit. The only way that that was addressed was a very kind PT coming out to my car and setting me up with like a wedge to sit on, to roll my hips forward, a lumbar pillow in my back, and another lumbar pillow that I put between my scapula so that I would be sitting in this perfect posture with hips rolled forward, shoulders back, you know, like super tense and rigid, trying to maintain that because it's good posture while I was driving. So that probably did more harm than good in actually making driving more comfortable. And I stuck with that for so long after being shown that too. Like, it persisted for a long time until I finally realized that what I needed was more like slouching, relaxation, ease, just being able to sit with ease, be able to move with ease, was something I hadn't been able to do in years.
So was at this point in time all of your movement just incredibly consciously contrived? Like you were moving like and sitting and doing in a very thoughtful way, but not thoughtful in a pleasant sense, but thoughtful in an obsessive sense. You are having to be very mindful of your mechanics in a way that should be subconscious.
Yeah. It was so effortful to just sit down or to stand up or to sleep. Like the positions I would try to force myself to sleep in were also very controlled so that I would maintain this idea of good posture, which was reinforced in all of the therapy that I had after surgery as well. And when my pain persisted after surgery, it was always biomechanical explanations. And it was back to like the strength and stability type explanations too, which all supported my biases and my thoughts on things too. But I became so rigid in my rules surrounding movement and posture that my movement just repertoire became smaller and smaller and smaller. And I would become so focused on biomechanics just while walking. I'd be thinking about my lumbopelvic rhythm, how my foot was striking the ground, like just super obsessive about all of this stuff. Being a heavy lifter before all of this too, like I was obsessive about form when I was lifting. And then that just carried over into every single aspect of my life where it hadn't before. I never thought about the position my body was in when I was sitting on the couch or, you know, getting up or going to bed. Like, none of that was ever something that I had controlled before all of this. It was like this insidious rule forming in habits that took place over time.
And on this timeline, is it, you've mentioned some injections and then surgery that is what we'd consider more interventional care, let's say. Were there other therapies that were attempted during what's been described so far on the timeline, or is it at this point in time that things were then introduced in terms of other interventions?
So after surgery, I had physical therapy again, post-op physical therapy. I did the CPM machine for 8 to 12 hours a day immediately after my surgery. Did physical therapy. When I still had pain after my physical therapy visits were up, because you get 24 and then you're done, my surgeon had recommended all sorts of things. The only thing that work comp would pay for was acupuncture, so I did acupuncture as well. I was paying out of pocket for massage during this time. It was actually my surgeon. So my surgery was like 13 months after the twinge. I medically retired from the department altogether 3 years to the day after the twinge, like 2 years after my surgery, almost 2 years after my surgery. At that time, I was still seeing my surgeon. He kind of overtook my care. My surgeon was wonderful. He was absolutely wonderful. He made me feel believed every single time I went in there. He never had a computer in front of him or a file in front of him. We would just have conversations. He included me in all of the decisions. I remember when he was making the decision to have surgery, we were sitting in the room and he was teaching like a fellow. I think the fellow was from the UK, how to do this arthroscopic surgery for FAI. And he's having this whole conversation and he never said that this was certain, that this would help. He always framed things in terms of uncertainty and probabilities and that kind of thing. And the fellow kept looking at me like, should she be in the room? And I remember my surgeon saying to him, like, it's her hip. Like, she should be part of these conversations. After my surgery, and it did resolve some deep visceral pain that I had had. So I don't necessarily think that my surgery was unwarranted, because that deep visceral pain, they often associate with bone pain. So I do think that the surgery did resolve some of those issues. And that was nauseating pain. Like it was awful. And that did resolve after that. But I still had the SI joint pain, the C pattern pain. But I didn't feel like my organs were being squeezed by gremlins anymore. And I was thankful for that. But after my surgery and I still had pain, he never made me feel like it was my fault. Never made me feel like it wasn't real. And he was the one that encouraged me to get out of the workers' compensation system, where I was so limited in the things that I could pursue and do, and to just start paying out of pocket and find my own way forward. So your pain, like, essentially is very real. Pain is very complex. There's more things going on here. I can't help you with that because I'm a surgeon. But there are other ways for you. So he was the one that planted the seed for me to find a different way.
Yeah, you mentioned just that it's the first mention that we've had here of the sacroiliac joint based on that being a location of symptoms. But you'd mentioned that, I think, at the conference, and something I've heard you speak, or I've seen some of your writings on this before, as to being shown a manual technique that was then instructed by your husband, was shown how to safely put a sacrum back in, or to untwist a pelvis and things. How did those sorts of things come about? Because it's certainly something that I've heard many a story in that direction, but never really involving the pressure that was clearly put onto your husband to administer a technique that was supposedly going to be curative.
It was horrible. And I really liked that PT as well. Like, he's a great guy. But he did manual thrust. He would do this manual thrust where he would put my SI joint back in. I was running out of visits. So he wanted to teach my husband how to do it so that we could continue to do it afterwards, because it was needed, you know. It was needed for this to happen, for this to take place. I had all these weird things that I would do myself too, where I'd stand like in this scissor position and I'd have my arm behind my back and use it kind of as a lever to try to put my SIJ back in. So my husband came in with me for one of my last appointments, and the PT showed him how to do this manual thrust, which was always super uncomfortable to begin with. I mean, because I'm this tense ball of pain all of the time. So trying to force my body to do anything is painful. He taught my husband how to do it. We went home, we did it one time, and I was just in tears, and it was awful. It was a terrible experience for both of us because it was painful. He's a recruiter, works on computers. He doesn't work on human bodies, putting things back in place. But what made it even more awful was the belief that this was something that I needed and that we couldn't do it. You know, that's so demoralizing, like thinking like this is the one thing that's going to fix this and we can't even do it. So where does that leave us? And that's just that part of it was devastating. This belief that that was something that I needed and that we were both failing me in that. That's a really shitty place to put people in, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I recall, I remember when hearing your story, it made me reacquaint myself with some of the literature I hadn't read in a long time regarding sort of the narrative reports of parents of children with cystic fibrosis, for example, that need to administer manual techniques as a means of loosening secretions and things. So certainly respiratory literature that I'm less au fait with now, but it was just that the stories that they tell about that responsibility and the necessity of that, in that case, a technique that has a mechanistic logic to it beyond
yours.
Right,
right.
And also certain things where even just the administering of injections and things like that, that are sometimes intramuscular injections for by carers and things like that, and lots of other techniques that are of essential need and the pressure that puts on any caregiver. But then for that to, so it's a huge pressure and certainly something that needs to be respected more than sometimes it is. But in this instance, they're setting you up in an instance where it's farcical in its mechanics. You know, it doesn't make, in those other examples I've given, there's a coherence to it where it's at least ever indicated, where in this instance, it's a misattribution or a misdiagnosis. And then the mechanics of the actual technique, it's something that's obviously farcical. So it's just so painful that this just misguidance on every which level, but again, suggested by a clinician who, in this instance, means well. You know, it's not as if he's a charlatan just sort of taking a punt on something. This is someone that believes something, that's transmitting what he thinks is the best care that you need. And then almost compassionately then, saying that you can't come back here for this all the time, therefore let's try and hand that over almost as a means of empowering you and your husband to take it on. It's just that initial mistake overthinking that that's the right thing to do means it sets off a chain of events that even a compassionate clinician then ends up misled on. It's why this ill education that seems to be going through and these treatment memes that seem to be pervasive in the industry, they're just
That's true for even just some of the exercise stuff too. Like there's a lot of criticism against the manual therapies and that's not carried over into some of the exercise explanations that were given too. That, you know, that it's to realign posture or correct biomechanics. Sure. That we're given these explanations too. I'm totally a believer of exercise, but some of the explanations that come along with those prescriptions are just as illogical and just as based in that fact. And that's what people are told and taught, and it becomes a part of their belief structure. So it's not like they're doing anything malicious or unethical. It's or unkind. Like they're being compassionate, caring clinicians. Mm. It's just that our educational systems are setting people up for failure, both clinicians and patients. That's the part that's so frustrating.
Yeah, we're often just wrong by accident. You know, it's not as if, people are willing to do these things. I totally agree. I think certainly in this manual therapy example, I suppose it sort of really landed with me in part because of the involvement of your husband. It's the equivalent in exercise of him being expected to correct for and assess for your glute activation, say, in a particular exercise, and him being responsible for make sure she doesn't do this wrong. You know, it was the involvement of him and what the pressure that put on both of you that really landed. But similarly, the sort of caricature-ish stereotype, shall we say, of, say, chiropractic care in terms of everyone's out of alignment And then the physiotherapy is falling into a trap often of a similar but slightly different caricature stereotype of, you know, everything's to do with weakness or instability of a different sort. Something that some argue is more obviously treatable in a sense. You can sort of, by suggesting that, it's a better flavor of myth, because at least you're giving them this notion that that's something that you can get stronger, get more flexible and things like that. But fundamentally at the heart of it, it's the same missed logic, isn't it? It's the way in which you're suggesting that this is something that is inherently biomechanical and biomedical, because it's something that needs to be stabilized or corrected for. So I'm totally with you. It's pervasive across all different flavors of treatment and across all different diagnoses. So yeah, thanks again for sharing those things. As I said, a low lights reel, shall we say, of different things. And so at this point, it probably seems smart for me to try and find out whereabouts in this process did you then become, you know, obviously through your studies that you've referred to, but at what point did this then, how did you become a patient advocate, expert patient, or famous patient voice that we now know you as? Like, when did that come about?
Famous. Totally accidentally. So when I was in school, so I was so lost when I medically retired from the fire department. I had no idea what I was going to do, and I loved fitness stuff. So I started a blog that I thought was going to be like this fitness blog. And it was very just as nebulous in my thinking as I'm expressing now. I had no idea what it was going to look like. But I started this blog, and it was absolutely terrible at first. But as I started to learn in school more about pain, I started writing about some of that in my blog. And then I had interviewed Laura Mermosley, mm-hmm. and that was probably a year after I had started my blog. And I started talking about pain a little bit more, and it started to resonate with people more than just this writing towards what I thought people wanted to hear in the fitness world. When I talked to Lormer on the phone, he told me he was going to be the keynote speaker at the San Diego Pain Summit the following year in 2015. So as soon as I got off Skype with him, I registered for the Pain Summit. And that was where things really started to change for me, and where I can kind of see where that my advocacy work started to happen. And it wasn't intentional. That was never my intention at the time. But I started talking with clinicians there. They started reading my blog. I started writing more personally and more vulnerably on my blog, rather than like trying to temper it or try to write for the masses. I was more writing for myself and trying to make sense of things and what I was learning from my school and learning from all of these clinicians that I had networked with at the San Diego Pain Summit. And just through that process of me trying to make sense of pain for myself, but sharing it with the world, just started interacting with really wonderful people in the pain space. I went to the San Diego Pain Summit every year, so kept up those relationships that I had met with those clinicians, the people that I had met through that, and over time just started being asked to do things, you know, to share my story. Those people that I started to interact with in that pain space then became an amplifier of my voice and my story, and started incorporating it either through sharing my blog with their patients or inviting me to speak at conferences, like Rajam invited me to speak at the San Diego Pain Summit 2 years ago on a patient panel. And I think that's where things really kind of launched. And then my whole goal has always been to amplify the voices of others too. So this awesome network of, you know, patients has kind of come about, that we all know each other and have been talking in the same circles, and that's the part that's really cool for me, and what keeps me going is just those people who are really trying to work towards making things better, to improving our understanding of pain, which can translate into better research, better care. So it's all been accidental, and it's just driven from wanting to do this better so that other people don't go through the same things that I did. Or for people who have been there, through where I have been, that they see that there's a way forward too.
Yeah, given that degree of hope of stories and journeys that they can recognize themselves in, that they can hopefully recognize an exit point from, or a way in which things become more manageable. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how some of the friends in common we have within that network that are examples that you've shared panels with, and I know discuss things with and keep in touch with. But I just, one of my almost concerns in that direction, though, is that much like you speaking to the man himself, Lauren Mosley, people like Tina meeting someone like Matt Lowe, Tina will hopefully have on the show soon. And whilst, you know, really cringes for me to almost sound like I'm putting myself in that similar category, but someone like Adrian, his course seemed to change a little by interacting with me and my business, and now, interestingly, seeing one of my colleagues for a different sporting problem that he's got that he's managing well. But just as a general rule, I worry that does it take for those almost interactions with, let's say, high profile clinicians for that to then change a course of you know, that's something that can't be necessarily translated to the masses very easily. That's what worries me, is that some of these higher profile stories of recovery that have formed an articulate advocacy that can help us to use as explanations. You know, my worry is that it took for such a what seems like a nuclear option of education, really, and also the theme that you've all noticed in each other. And I know you and Adrian spoke, and Pete spoke about this on the panel at the Reforming MSK conference, where you were all sort of admitting that there's a sort of a style of character you've noticed in each other that's sort of a similarity. So a worry of mine is that similarity is great in some ways for us to hear your voices, but also sometimes doesn't seem necessarily as representative, and might be worrying that if that's what it takes to change the courses in each of your lives, that doesn't seem like it's very translatable across the masses. I wonder what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, well, and so I would flip that, because the interactions that I had, like with Lorimer, I didn't know that he was a big... Like, I didn't know him as like a famous pain science guy at that time. I had just read articles that he had written and reached out to him via the email on one of the articles to do this interview. And it was only later that I realized that he was this very entertaining personality, because I had never seen him speak. Sure. I never saw the TEDx talk. I never saw any of that stuff before I interviewed him. What was so powerful about that conversation wasn't that he was this famous, preeminent neuroscientist guy. It was that he spent time listening to my story and having a conversation with me. It was that sense of being a person of worth and value, that he would listen to me, and that he wasn't coming at this as this expert that was going to tell me what my pain was and what to do about it. It was a shared conversation and it was a personal conversation. He shared his own stories. He shared his own personal experiences with pain. So it was a dialogue. It was a conversation that opened the door to other options and possibilities of moving forward. And his statement to love and be loved, that was powerful, not because it came from Lorimer Mosley, but because it was a powerful statement for me at that time when I was feeling at a particularly low place and feeling pretty unlovable and unloving at that time. So anyone can do that. Anyone can have a conversation with a person in pain and help them see what possible options there might be. Anyone can sit with someone and validate that person's experiences and hear their story and listen to understand rather than listen to respond. That is so incredibly powerful. And what was so powerful about that experience. And for me, and I have been incredibly fortunate to have been able to interact with some of the heavy hitters in this space, because I was a patient demo for Peter O'Sullivan as well. And the most impactful part of that experience for me was when we sat down and him asking me to tell him my story. In all of my years of care, I'd never been asked that question before. And I was 7 years into my pain experience at that time. And just by opening up that conversation with that prompt, tell me your story, really helped me to connect my own dots, because I didn't tell the story of the pain I was having in my left hip, which I had been having for like 7 months prior to that encounter. I went all the way back to stepping off that fire engine and feeling the twinge in my right hip that had happened 7 years before. And it just highlighted to me, helped me connect my own dots about how fearful I was of going back to that time, going back, following that same path where I was going to lose everything again. That's what I was afraid of. I was afraid that I was going to lose all of these things that I had built back up. I was afraid I wasn't going to be able to do the things that made me feel like me again. And those conversations were so meaningful because they were conversations, you know, like, and anybody has the power to do that. Anyone has the ability to say, tell me your story and be able to just sit with rather than try to do to all the time. So I think it gives hope that I think these examples give hope that things can change. Keith Meldrum, who is another patient advocate, he tells the story about the turning point for him. And he's lived with pain for 33 years now, after a near fatal car accident when he was 16. He felt dismissed. I mean, he was dismissed in his care for many of those years. And he was explicitly told, essentially, that his pain was all in his head. When he went to get a spinal cord stimulator, he was going through like a pain management clinic. He had to do this whole intake. And the clinic that he went to had a very biopsychosocial approach to pain care. And during that intake, he kind of like shut down, shut off, because he'd been through it so many times and nobody's ever listening anyway. And he realized that like the doctor had stopped talking and that he was probably supposed to respond to something. And he looked at the doctor and the doctor just put his hand on his knee and said, "We believe you." And for Keith, that changed everything. It opened up the door to a different way forward for him. Just hearing the words, "We believe you." Everyone has the ability to give that to a person living with pain. And I don't think it's recognized how dismissed we feel, especially when we've been in pain for a long time, how invalidated we feel because our pain hasn't been found on a scan or an image, or we've had surgery to fix all the things and now there's nothing left to fix. We've done all the movement corrections. There's no more movement left to correct. You know, like all of these, when you've been through it all, that's so invalidating because no one has a good explanation for why you're still in pain. Anyone can help people to understand their pain differently and to find a different path forward. So to me, that gives me hope. And those, they're not easy things to do, but they're simple. You know, like being able to sit with and listen to understand, not easy. But it's also simple, and it's something that anybody can do and anybody can learn and practice. And we're all going to mess it up. I mess it up all the time. But part of all of this is coming back to our shared humanity as well, that people coming before you are coming before you because they are suffering. They are dealing with something that they do not know how to deal with, and they need help moving forward. And if we can ground everything in that and be compassionate and non-judgmental and help people to find their own path forward, I think that anybody can do that.
So we've spoken a little bit about some of the suspicion that seems to be left at the feet of patients where the pain is something that's too complex for clinicians to comprehend, and therefore the question mark gets raised over its legitimacy. And certainly over the years when an understanding of pain was shallow, and therefore, if it didn't fit in the existing paradigm, it was assumed to be false rather than it being something that was yet to be understood. And therefore, there's a lot of apologies that we all owe to many clinicians. Many patients as clinicians.
I would argue to clinicians too, because they were taught those things.
Of course. Yeah, no, it's a good mistake for it to have made, because of course, as we talked about earlier, that we're often all wrong by accident, as we described. Part of another mechanism that maybe has driven that, and I feel is from speaking to many clinicians and obviously being one myself, is that there are occasions in which there feels that despite a better enlightened understanding of the complexity of symptoms, it does sometimes mean that we occasionally, albeit and hopefully for most people, a minority of cases where it does feel like sometimes there is a legitimacy to the symptoms being felt, but also the way in which they're being represented sometimes in a social system, there are occasions in which they might be being leveraged for, you mentioned compensation variables, etc. So the existence of what we're overly dismissed as being malingerers is a term that was sometimes used, or this failed treatment syndrome type stuff where people are going around a cycle. But there are circumstances in which, as clinicians, sometimes that skepticism is over prevalent because those people might be, although in a minority, they feel like they're sometimes encountered. And as a firefighter, I hope you don't mind me using the analogy that there are, we need to, when someone calls the fire brigade, they need to be treated with all seriousness. But unfortunately, a small percentage of those are false calls for whatever reason that they might be doing so. And so if someone who was an operator that was answering those calls was to be over skeptical of every call, of course that's not helpful, but also part of what then drives certain skepticisms, and sometimes the fault is sometimes on the prank callers, shall we say. And so that part of that dynamic is incredibly complex, because we don't want to be victim blaming of a sort, but also some responsibility perhaps on the sort of social conversation needs to be that we need to recognize what is the responsibility of us as a society at large to make sure that we're articulating ourselves clearly and articulating ourselves honestly and recognizing what are the factors at play that are making us behave in a certain way. And in some occasions, albeit on a minority of cases, it could well be that these symptoms are being, that they are present, say, and they are affecting things, but there could also be other drivers that might be affecting the way in which they are impairing function or being suggested to impair function for other gains. Now, a classically long way around me asking that question, but I hope, do you feel that that is an area of the conversation that is easy or difficult for us to sort of deal with? And do you feel that there is any responsibility that could be laid at the feet of those that are the equivalent in our industry of prank calls?
I would, like, so how would you know if they're a prank caller? Hmm. How do you know? And should we treat everyone, if it's, let's say it's 5% of people who are doing that, should we treat the other 95% with skepticism because they might not be forthright in their symptoms? So, and what would be the harm in treating all people compassionately? What would be the harm in recognizing, for whatever reason this person is making these decisions, to treat them as a human being and with compassion? What is the harm in that? And what would be the harm in treating everyone with skepticism who is having very real pain, very real suffering? One of the things that in my care, because we talk about secondary gains a lot in healthcare and in the compensatory systems, medical legal systems, it was in a conversation at the San Diego Pain Summit with Jason Silvernail, where he talked about how we don't recognize the primary losses of people who have, lost so much because of their pain or their suffering experience. And oftentimes those secondary gains are so much less than what people have lost. I'm not sure what systems are like elsewhere, but when I was on the workers' compensation system, my compensation was about a third of what I was making when I was working as a firefighter. I was making a third of the money. My checks, my secondary gains, were barely enough for us to pay our mortgage. We were worried that we were going to lose our house. Those gains are often very difficult gains to live by. And I think that's important to recognize too. Humans are complex. Our behavioral drivers are all complex, and we're never going to understand what is driving one individual's particular choices. And that societal conversation that we need to have, I think, is a really important one. And it's not about laying responsibility at the feet of anybody or blaming anybody for anything. It's about creating, inclusive environments, safe environments for people that they have the ability to thrive and flourish. And we don't have that. There's a lot of people who faced very difficult things as children, who might have been impoverished or food insecure or been traumatized in some way. And that's going to affect their decisions in later life as an adult. Should we judge them for that? Because maybe they didn't grow up safe. And so now their reactions and their behaviors are founded in something that we can't go back and change, but we can work with that person towards epigenetic changes that will change their trajectory moving forward. Mm-hmm. Is it going to work for every? Are you going to like every patient? Are you going to be able to help every patient? No, that's never going to be the case. It's because humans are complex, and it's okay to not be able to help everybody. It's okay to not like everybody. But I think if we always ground everything in compassion, in the sense of you know, common humanity, then those questions take care of themselves. I would rather treat everybody with compassion rather than doubt somebody when I have no way of knowing what their motivations are, no way of knowing what their internal experience is, no way of knowing what they've been through as a human being or what they're going through as a human being, unless I live in their shoes.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell that, that we agree on the definite, the correct instinct for us all to develop and to lean on is one of belief, of compassion, of hearing and legitimizing that narrative that is sort of their subjective experience of symptoms. I suppose in the instance of where, you know, the how do you know, it's not about necessarily me just sort of the belief in the description of the symptoms as much as there could be an overt dishonesty that could be identifiable with regards to the way in which that someone might be describing, unless they are subjecting or which is an occasion in which they are sort of, there is an overt objective delusion to what they perceive they can and can't do, quite obviously. But if they're describing the fact that it's sort of, I can't climb stairs, and you say, well, what, some of the time or all the time, and they say, I haven't climbed a flight of stairs for 3 years, yet there is evidence of them having climbed stairs 3 weeks before. These are instances which, again, are admittedly rare, but these are overt dishonesties. And therefore, if we were to suggest that that person's complex story, albeit very unique to them, including some of the other long-term life variables that have affected them, if we were to suggest that they hold no responsibility for that dishonesty in that moment, then we'd deprive them of agency, wouldn't we? So in circumstances like this, whilst a small part potentially of the wider jigsaw puzzle, I'm sort of wondering as to whether you feel there is a responsibility in those instances that they are the ones that are contributing to the muddy water, which we're admitting is also being muddied by various other factors, and that to totally take away that from the societal need for us to also be honest, not just about the legitimacy of symptoms, but also the way in which when interacting with health services, that we need to try and make sure that that happens both ways, that when things are believed, they also need to be shared in an honest way in which they're affecting people's function.
These are complex issues. Like for me, if someone is coming in and saying, I haven't been able to climb a flight of stairs in 3 years, and there's evidence of them doing it 3 weeks before, my curiosity then is, so why is there this discrepancy in exploring that? Is there... what is going on there for this discrepancy to have, and digging deeper, you know, asking, and then why, and going deeper and deeper and deeper into that, and trying to understand this individual as a human being rather than forming judgment or accusations. Because it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to help that person. It doesn't mean that you're ever going to come to the same page. But I think that there'd be more benefit gained in trying to understand where that person is coming from than just dismissing them in like kicking them to the curb because you're framing their experience as dishonest, where their way of framing it might not be in dishonesty. It might be in not recognizing their abilities to do things. It might be lie somewhere else. And obviously I don't know who these individuals are, so I can't. And I've never encountered anything like that, but figuring out more would be the direction that I would go, if you have the capacity to do so. And if not, then you don't. If that's not within your purview to be able to do, then you don't. Sure. But I think that withholding judgment and withholding accusation is really important. And I that goes both ways too. I mean, there's a lot of patients who are angry about their care that they received. And that care that they received is very contextual too. You know, there's so many factors that go into all of these things, and we don't always know what all of those factors are. And until we recognize that bigger picture, I think that it's important to reserve judgment always. But just if someone is there's this big a discrepancy in their life, like that can't be an easy life to live for that person. You know, if they are desperately trying to say, I can't climb stairs, what is driving that? You know, what is, and it's not, happiness and joy, that's for sure.
Sure.
It's not contentedness and living a good life. Mm. Like there's suffering there.
Yeah.
That's not the life that I would want to lead. Mm. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
So I think holding things in that kind of frame, and it's hard to do. And I don't do this all the time either. You know, mm. being able to, there's an entire spectrum of humanity, mm. you know, there's people who fall all along that spectrum. We want everyone to be on one end of it, but that's not how human beings work. And it's mm. never going to be how human beings work. Mm. Everyone is not going to be our ideal human being.
Yeah.
Do we just dismiss them then?
No,
or do we say there's room for everybody
and we'll help them in the ways
that we can?
Better, yeah. I mean, exactly, and I totally understand that the way in which we get to, let's draw on more information and elicit more information to try and allow to clarify this story, absolutely, than to be dismissive. And certainly we need to lean resources in the direction of having more time and more opportunity and the structure to allow for that sharing of things in someone's own language. Out of interest, when you were a firefighter, did you have a similar sort of, I know the analogy is not perfect, but did you have a similar sort of take on the matter? So if I was to, unfortunately I haven't got my time machine with me, but if I was able to try and find out what was Joletta Belton's take on prank callers of calling in false fires 15 years ago, was it a similar sort of take on that matter as you have now?
Oh, I was incredibly judgmental and a bit of a dick back in those days. and not just like in fires, but I was a paramedic too. And I always thought of myself as a compassionate medic, and I always thought of myself as a caring person. But in looking back now, I realize how judgmental I was. When I was in paramedic school, we were explicitly taught that fibromyalgia was not real.
No.
So as compassionate a medic as I tried to be when I went on calls with people who had that diagnosis, I know that I was being judgmental. And I know that probably carried over into my care of those people as well. Those types of calls were like, we would call them frequent flyers for like some patients. We would call frequent flyers the people who call 911 a lot, and often for not non-emergency situations. And we would be incredibly frustrated and not necessarily positive in the ways we would talk about those patients that called 911 a lot. And I remember complaining, you know, this is not an emergency, not to the patients themselves, but just
us
back at the firehouse. And then during my experience with pain, when I was in the workers' compensation system, my lowest point was a time when I hadn't been able to sleep for 2 weeks. And all I wanted was more physical therapy because I liked physical therapy, supported all my biases. I would just go in and work out. Mm-hmm. I always felt temporarily better, sure. at least while I was there. So I had called my work comp adjuster to see if I could get a physical therapy appointment. And she told me I had to get a referral from my surgeon. This is almost 2 years after my surgery. Or at least a year after my surgery. Like, could it be a phone call or do I have to go in to see him? I'd have to go in to see him. It would take 9 weeks to get in to see him. So for this flare-up that I was having immediately, this inability to sleep for 2 weeks that I was experiencing right now, I would have to go to see my surgeon 9 weeks from now to then get a referral that would have to be approved to get PT. So I was upset and I was crying. I was in my office in the wellness and fitness department at the firehouse or at the headquarters of our fire department, crying, which is embarrassing because people in the gym could see me. And I was just desperate for anything at that time because I was in so much pain. And she said, if you're really in that much pain, go to the ER, the emergency room, which is what I had bitched so much about when I was a firefighter, when people used the 911 system or the emergency room system to deal with issues that were not emergent. And I'm like, so our systems put people in terrible positions. You know, they put them in terrible positions. The person who was coordinating my care told me to go to the emergency room for pain I'd been having for over 2 years. Like, that just doesn't make any sense. So that helped me to see how wrong I had been in some of the judgments that I had made when I was a firefighter. And I made a lot of them in those days. I mean, I made a lot of judgments on, you know, people who had drug use problems, people, you know, all sorts of people. I was not as compassionate as I would have liked to have thought myself at that time.
Yeah.
And in looking back now, I would do things differently if I was in that a similar situation. But I don't know if I would have learned those lessons had I not been on the other side of things.
And it does make sense. And it's certainly that's the interesting sort of psychosocial gray area of where the circumstances and the system lead to someone seeking care in what might be in that moment an inappropriate location or circumstance, but actually it's the story that's come behind it is super relevant to it. I suppose the examples where I'm talking about prank callers or particularly fraudulent people, which are in the vast minority, there is a circumstance there where, from what I understand from speaking to firefighters, at least in this country, that because it's such a complex social and psychological phenomenon, why people will make overtly prank calls, not necessarily for their own needs, but just a fire that doesn't exist, for example. There is an understanding from what I've heard from them that is something, unfortunately, that while we try and get to understand it, we need to try and make the social pressure to know that that is not okay, because it's a waste of resources. But fundamentally, the system therefore has to compensate for that corner of those calls. You know, it's a necessary evil almost. Do you feel that potentially, to exhaust that analogy a little bit, do you feel that because this that the healthcare system has so much to gain from being inherently trusting and inherently compassionate, that essentially the minority of fraudsters need to just be accounted for by the system and accounted for by the resources? Because until, you know, because we haven't got an easy measure of separating that off, it just needs to be par for the course, and just like the fraudster prank caller on in a fire circumstance, that essentially for those circumstances where someone is misusing resources, that's just a necessary evil in a similar fashion.
Yeah, I mean, and probably, and when you look at that, like the prank callers for fire, so why is that person making that call? And is there any mechanism in place to discover that and to change that behavior? Is there any social systems in place to address that specific issue? And probably not. There probably isn't. And should we be looking at those types of things to just improve the general health of society overall? Nothing is ever going to be perfect. There should always be a buffer. Should be some means of being able to handle those types of calls or those types of things.
I think it's fair to say that, especially from what I understand of your work, I mean, I doubt you'd give me an answer that's going to surprise me here, but the question I've written down is, how integrated do you feel patient narratives should be in MSK conversations? And I almost feel like I know the answer is very, but could you articulate a little bit about how and what you feel the best mechanism for involving patient narratives in MSK conversations and also then MSK care? How do you feel the best mechanism is that? Because you've got some really quite innovative ways in which you've been involved in recently, that you've launched recently.
Yeah, well, it's such a good question. And I don't know the answers, and I'm hoping that we're going to discover those answers.
Sure.
And almost model the process that I'm hoping that we'll discover. But so I have a couple new roles that are going to be diving into these issues further. Like one is an editorial role, the patient and public partnership editor for the Journal of Sports and Orthopedic Physical Therapy, where we're looking at how to make those kinds of partnerships or integrating, you know, patient perspectives into the journal, and what does that look like, and into research that's submitted to the journal. And then I've also been named co-chair of the IASP Global Alliance of Pain Patient Advocates. GAPA is our acronym.
There's so many acronyms. You did really well there. I was like, I always trip up.
but that is going to be looking towards how do we integrate patient voices into our understanding of pain, into the study of pain, researching pain, and then pain care. And it's kind of new for the pain space to be doing this. And I'm so grateful for conferences like yours who are integrating the patient voices into those educational opportunities for clinicians. The San Diego Pain Summit, Pain Cloud, all of these organizations that are already doing this in some ways as we fumble through it because we don't know exactly what it looks like. But I think that what is so important is having conversations where those patient voices are present, so that we can maybe explore questions a little bit differently. Are the research questions that that we are asking, are they relevant to patients? And could they be altered or tweaked in ways that make them more relevant to patient outcomes or patient interests? There's been some interesting things that have happened. I think it was a tendinopathy conference where patients were a part of a Delphi survey with clinicians and researchers to come up with like what was most important in tendinopathy care. And some of the things that were most important to patients were not even on like the clinicians and researchers' radars, And then through this Delphi process, they agreed upon all of these different measures that were going to be important. And those ones that were important to patients, which were more along the lines of like psychosocial factors, how disruptive a tendon injury, tendinopathy can be to life. Addressing red flags seems to be really, really important to patients. Often like there's reassurance provided, but without addressing that specifically. And that was more important to patients than was to researchers and clinicians. So just having those types of conversations, I think, is really valuable to figure out what are we looking at? What is important in research and clinical care? And what matters to patients? And having those discussions with all three of those people at the table, or I mean, more than just three people, but
stakeholder groups, yeah. I'm with you.
But having, you know, people who are actually in clinical practice and researchers and patients come together to see if we're solving for the right problems, because maybe we're not. Maybe we'd be surprised by what we learn from what is important to patients. I think when it comes to all this stuff too, it's important to note that it's not just listening to patient voices during care, which is also very important. I think those are kind of two different streams. Listening to patient voices in care is really important too, that listening to understand, that validation. Because, I mean, one of the things that drives me nuts when I hear it is that patients aren't motivated. If patients are waking up every single day, they are motivated by something. So it's just that they're not motivated in the same ways that that particular clinician would like them to be motivated. And those are two different things. So it's about having those conversations to come to a shared understanding, which is likely not going to be ideal, and figuring out a way forward for that particular individual. Outside of that, though, and more that kind of Delphi study approach and this idea of bringing together clinicians and patients and researchers, that's including patients or people with lived experience who aren't directly being cared for by those people, if that makes sense. Like, so it's having this other perspective come in just to make it more of a well-rounded and complete perspective. I think it's really important in educational settings too to have that patient voice integrated from the very beginning. Like, what if we grounded the educational experiences of healthcare professionals from the very beginning in patient stories? That could be a really powerful way of framing everything that is learned in that environment, and always keep it in what is important, because no one goes into becoming a physical therapist without the idea that they're going to treat patients or work with people. You know, like, people are always going to be a part of that. So what if we ground that from the very beginning in those things, and maybe even work backwards? Like, from what are we trying to understand when it comes to pain? What are we trying to do in pain care? And then working backwards and including patients in that process, or people with lived experience in that process of finding out how to get there, rather than just always doing things the way we've always done them. And I think that could be truly reformative. That could be truly revolutionary when it comes to this. It's just about approaching education and research with that perspective included, not being the sole perspective, that perspective being integrated into clinical and research perspectives, and coming to, you know, share things where not everyone's going to be happy probably with what is come to. Like, researchers probably want to go one way, clinicians one way, patients another way, but there is common ground there too that I think that we can come to. The whole area of like co-production and co-creation is one that I'm new to in these roles, and what that actually looks like. And I think that's where a lot of times patients are kind of brought in after to give their input on whatever has been created, to include them in like materials that are shared with patients, in you know, group programs that might be developed, in exercise programs that might be developed, including them from the very start, is what I would like to see.
Yeah, I think that's become sort of there's almost this tokenistic filter, isn't there? Oh, let's see what a sample of patients think about this thing that they can tinker with maybe a bit, rather than an equal stakeholder sort of partner from the off in every level, and trusting that, as we talked about, that true agency and involvement, and making sure we have a common language and things like that we can share, so that then we're respecting each other. And it's also just you can make a real strong case for the patient-centeredness is so important, that it's hilarious that we might think that we want them as an equal partner. It's actually, no, it's if ever there was a case for supremacy of decision-making, then it should be that the heart of the actual care receivers. I suppose one gap there, though, that starts to become a challenge is that because of your story and being integrated within education and further study of a high level, and also we've talked about your experience with various different, especially as an advocate, meeting and integrating with various different people that are of a specialism in this stuff, and becoming a specialist in many ways yourself. Means that I think we've spoken about this before. You know, we're not going to argue that you are representative of every person that has an ankle sprain, say, and is their first experience of MSK pain, and nor are any clinicians. But therefore, the challenge comes with regards to there being a disconnect sometimes in levels of expertise. So a patient will have an inherent expertise in their own lived experience. They know what they know, and they know far more about themselves and how it's affecting themselves than the clinician. But there could well be, and this is the negotiation I encounter in clinic all the time, and I call it a negotiation, and it's a challenge and a disagreement between us, is that I know what I know and they know what they know. And whilst they are true experts in what the way in which this is affecting them and the way that their symptoms behave, their attribution to what might be causing that or contributing to it sometimes can be something that I just disagree with, and vice versa. And so that's where sometimes on a one-to-one level, that negotiation is at the heart of my care and the shared decision-making process that we're having in clinic, and we're trying to make central to what everything we do, and obviously the centric circles around all of our work through this podcast and beyond, as you know. But then the big bit for me is that when that then bleeds into conversations, be that online or when we're trying to create focus groups, etc., that those things, those differences of opinion, when we are sometimes trying to represent others, sometimes can be very challenging because of the identity of each person's individual lived experience, both as patients and as clinicians, means that sometimes, because they're not transferable beyond us, that sometimes that's how things break down. That negotiation on a one-to-one level about someone's knee is going to be different to two people talking about knees generally or pain generally. And that seems to be where conversation seems to break down quite. That's where I've noticed that interstakeholder, shall we say, conversations between patients and clinicians can break down easier than they can one-to-one. And that's what concerns me, because I think that we're all wanting the same things, but sometimes we're struggling to find a common style or parlance in which we can challenge each other without necessarily then it breaking down in a negative way, because I think that might be a big threat to the model that we're both sort of fans of.
Well, and I don't know if what I'm going to say is going to speak to that at all. I think that part of the issue with that, and maybe some of the resistance from the patient side of things, is often feeling invalidated through some of those discussions. And I think it's important that we validate their stories. You don't have to validate their explanation, but you can validate that's their understanding of their experience. And oftentimes we skip that step of validation and just go straight to challenging the explanations. And it's going to be messy because we're all humans. So that's for sure. And it's all new like this, but it's not new in other areas of care and where they have been doing this for a while, like mental or behavioral health. We're calling it behavioral health now in Colorado, which I like better because I think it carries less of the whole mental kind of stigma that can be associated with mental health. Sure. But it's been happening in that space and disability space for quite some time. And it's just going to take continuing to have conversations and muddling through it, figuring it out as we go. One of the things that I have seen, though, and it's something I wrote in my Meanings of Pain chapter, the second volume of Meanings of Pain is out, and I had the good fortune of being able to contribute to it, was that oftentimes, and I don't think we always see it, I mean, everyone is coming to these conversations with their own narrative, whether it's a clinical narrative or a scientific narrative or a person's personal narrative. And the scientific and clinical narratives have traditionally been privileged over the patient's narrative.
Yeah.
So I think coming to all of these conversations, maybe with a little bit of humility on for all parties, is really important. And understanding that we don't know a lot about pain. So coming in with certainty and challenging patient narratives isn't always helpful, because it often comes from a place of certainty when there isn't that certainty inherent in the actual research and understanding of what pain is and what to do about it. And I think that can be one of those barriers that we need to overcome. It's just all coming at it with some humility. In terms of incorporating, you know, patient voices too, patients are going to fall along, people with lived experience are going to fall upon this whole spectrum of experience and being able to articulate that experience. And I talk all the time about when I was in those dark years of my pain, when I wasn't leaving my house, when I was isolated and withdrawn, I was not articulate about my experience at all. I didn't have any understanding or any of these insights into my experience then that I do now. But it's also important to understand where people are who are still kind of in that chaos, who are in that darkness, who are in that abyss. We need to hear from them as well, not just those of us who are articulate about our experiences and can speak to the research and all of that. And I think it's really important to emphasize that those of us that are in this space that have a platform, we are not representative of everybody. You know, we're not representative of everybody's experience. Yeah. We need to be inclusive and including all sorts of stories to better our understanding of pain. Because if we don't understand what that darkness is like, and I try to speak to my own darkness and abyss as eloquently as possible, but it's also really hard to do that because it was chaos back then. And when I look back at that time, all I see is pain. Like, it's just like this neon flashing sign of pain, pain, pain. That's all I remember. I don't remember much else. Like, I don't remember how I spent 3 years of my life, you know, like,
yeah,
I can't remember what a day.
Say,
yeah. I can't remember what a day was like. I don't remember, like, did I used to make the coffee or did, like, just all of these little things you totally lose track of. But for us to truly understand pain, we need to understand what the lived experience of pain is like. Mm. We need to understand what living with these different conditions is like, whether they're painful or not, in order to truly understand the experience and be able to address it in care. I think there's a lot of frustration on the part of clinicians because so much of what we do for chronic pain in particular is not helpful. I think that we're only going to find things that are helpful if we find out from patients what is helpful, you know, like what and what their experience is and how treatment can be incorporated into their lived lives, which might include things like poverty and food insecurity, you know, little access to safe places to exercise. Like, there's all of these things that might be in place for particular individuals that we don't do a very good job of addressing as healthcare systems in general.
We often get asked, like people writing into the show or on social media and things, as patients, an increasing amount of patients that listen, some of which we're trying to get, you know, get on the show. Sam Williams is a great example of that, who kicked off our Patient Matters, and obviously that's how I met Adrian initially. But generally, they often ask, how would I broach this with my care providers and clinicians generally? When they've become a little more, shall we say, enlightened in that direction, or they're recognizing on the base level that there's more of a holistic pattern to this and there's more factors, more jigsaw pieces to this puzzle than has been suggested to them, how best should they raise that? So how should patients challenge clinicians is the core of the question. I wonder if you were, I've always sort of fairly bottled that, you know, so I wondered if you could help me with it.
That's a really good question. And I haven't been in a place where I've sought care for my pain since I kind of became enlightened to sure. new ways of thinking about it. So I don't quite know how I would handle, it's funny because I'm even thinking about like getting a gym membership, which I haven't done in ages. And I'm like, like, what if I hear nonsense from people? Like, what would I do if that happens? Because I tend to do all my exercise and movement outside. I live in the mountains, that's my playground. That's my gym. But I'm like, what if I were to hear nonsense? Like, how would I challenge it? Like, if I was working with a trainer. It was really interesting when, like, just my primary care physician that I had when I was still in California, when I would talk about things, he's like, he actually would say, you are probably more educated in this regard than I am. So I had a very humble practitioner who knew I lived with chronic pain and also knew that I had studied it and done all of these other things and probably was more familiar with what was going to be good for me than he did. So he was a very humble practitioner. So there was no challenge there. Mm-hmm. And it was more just me saying, hey, I've got pain in my hip that I've had for some time. It's not a problem. I don't have any issues that you need to address, but I just want to put it out there. But so how to actually do that and challenge clinicians, I just don't even know. I think the clinicians that would be challenged probably wouldn't be open to having this conversation. Mm. Or perhaps they would. I shouldn't make judgment on that.
Mm. It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because it's when I try to wade my way through an answer on that, it's usually dependent on how receptive they perceive the clinician might be to it, or if they, you know, trying to find an avenue that's going to not put their defences up in an overt way, or introducing a topic or a theme inquisitively, like asking a genuine question, not a contrived passive aggressive question.
Right.
But it's as per usual, we're talking about individual specificity again, aren't we? And I suppose the same things. I think I've often said to them, just trust your social instincts as to whether or not you feel it's appropriate, so that even though this might be something that you've become knowledgeable enough to be angry about the care being provided by them or by others, then if possible, you know, raise that when you're in a place where you can ask a very genuine question of it, where not a question that you know the answer to or you perceive you know the answer to, but genuinely inquire as to why that direction of travel has been taken. And I hope that's something that's better than nothing. But generally speaking, I'm glad you thought it were a tough question, because I certainly do when I receive it.
Yeah.
And there's no easy one to it.
I like that idea of just asking a genuine question, or just saying, I've learned this. And
what's
I'm thinking about doing this. So what do you think about that? Because I have learned this, I'm thinking about, you know, whatever it might be, hiking more.
I'm thinking of doing something more, or I'm thinking of not doing that. And, you know, it's like very genuinely.
What do you think about that? And posing questions to kind of start a dialogue that way. Mm. And it's funny, like in thinking about that, because we tend to always talk about, like, the patients need to be challenged, their beliefs need to be challenged, and we forget that clinicians are humans too, and sometimes, you know, the behavior change is equally as hard for them as it is for the people that they're trying to enact behavior change in. And I get pushback about, like, some of the narrative approaches that I talk about, and people think it's out of their purview to be able to just have a conversation with the patient, that it's psychology. Which is just ridiculous, in my opinion, to think that having a conversation with someone is too psychological, because we do it every day all sorts of situations.
It's all about that. People get so deluded by the context of a patient-therapist interaction that they completely miss the fact that if you two bumped into each other on a bus, you would not consider that a psychological intervention. You would be talking about each other's what's been bothering you in a different circumstance. So it's such a funny thing that we get kind of blinkered, don't we, by the walls of a clinic room or a gym or whatever it might be, a surgeon's office. So it's such a weird phenomena. I suppose I wonder if I could try, let's explore the flip of that question then. How might clinicians challenge patients appropriately if they feel it's indicated?
Do you mean like an explanation that they may have?
Yeah, just generally, we talked about how might patients challenge clinicians best if they feel there's a difference of opinion. How might clinicians challenge patients best if they feel there is a difference of opinion in conversation?
Well, and I think that questioning is the best way to do that. You know, like actually exploring issues a little bit further, going a little bit deeper into things. Because oftentimes, then, like the the idea or the argument will challenge itself the more you go into it. Like, does that make sense with your experience of being able to do this? That's what Peter O'Sullivan did with me when I was worried about my going down that same path with my left hip. Because I was still doing things. I had stopped running. I had stopped doing a bunch of other things with this worry. Because it's even with all that I know, with new pain in my left hip, I was like, it's got to be damage. It's got to be, you know, sure. Like something structural. Right, like right. I immediately went back to those explanations. But I was still snowboarding. I'd stopped running, but I was still snowboarding. He's like, if it was unstable in any way, if it was weak in any way, would you be able to snowboard? Like using things from a person's lived life to challenge some of their ideas about things, I think can be a gentle approach to doing that. And having it be more exploratory rather than accusatory, you know, like exploring these notions with that person. And maybe they're not ready to go there just yet, but sure. That exploratory question can plant a seed for the future too. One of the books that I love is by John Lonner. It's called Narrative Based Approaches in Health and Social Care. And then the subtitle is Conversations Inviting Change. And that idea of conversations inviting change is just so appealing to me because it leaves the door open for there not being a prescriptive way of doing this or a prescriptive way of challenging a narrative. And it's not necessarily so much about challenging. It's more about having a conversation and a negotiation, like you referred to earlier. Mm-hmm. And it's two people having a conversation and a negotiation about things, and it's probably never going to end up being an ideal path forward in the clinician's mind. Like, you might want this person to eat better, sleep better, exercise more, do all of these things, but that's probably not what it's going to translate to into real life, at least not all at once, because behavior change is friggin' hard for all of us. Sure. So having those conversations and negotiations and framing it in terms of things that are valuable and meaningful to a person can be a really good entry point into that. Finding out what is meaningful to a person and helping them to get back to that can open the door to possibilities of challenging some beliefs that might be holding them back from that thing. Sure. 'Cause I mean, I know for me and we have to recognize too that people who are living with pain are coming to their beliefs about that pain within this broader context of all of the healthcare professionals that they've seen prior to coming to you, societal narratives that we have about pain and what to do about it, which are still primarily like damage-based rest kind of narratives. And the people in their lives are going to influence those beliefs too. Like, there's so much that goes into it. It's not just this one individual. And that's why I think it's so important for us to address things on a broader level too, like in our educational systems, in the healthcare systems in general, in the societal narratives that we're putting forth. That's why I love the work of like Mary O'Keefe and those that are doing things in popular media as well. Because we need to change so much at so many different levels in order to be able to foster individual change, if that makes sense. Because it's hard to have a conversation and be like, yeah, this is a great way forward, and then you go out into the real world and everyone's like, no, you shouldn't do that, you should protect your back, or whatever it might be. It's really hard to be able to challenge those beliefs if they're surrounded by a counter narrative in their real life.
Sure. And that's totally agree. I just sound like I'm shoehorning it in everywhere, but it's why when we decided as to how to progress or how might a reformative agenda emerge from these and other conversations like these, then it needed to be multifaceted. It needed to understand how we might influence better messaging in the media. What is the underlying governance underneath the structures that indicate how structures are and services are built, and how do we aspire to better care and quality care and things. It needed to be all those different things, which is obviously what we're trying to achieve. And thank you to you and to other patients and of course everyone that's been contributing to that work that we're obviously going to be climaxing with this manifesto soon, and that's great. I wanted to just wrap up and ask if you could direct listeners to where they can find more about you and or any recommendations as to what they might do to find out more about some of the things that we've talked about.
I haven't been as active on my blog recently, but there is still all my past years there, and that's mycupofjoe.com, mycupofjoe.com. And there's a contact form there too. So if anyone wanted to get a hold of me, they can always contact me through that as well. I also have a nonprofit that there's a resource page on the nonprofits page, and that's epicolorado.org. And if you go to the resource page, there's tons of resources there. There's, and it's separated by patients, kind of science-y stuff, and then for clinicians. So those are two good places to go. I'm also working with the Retrain Pain Foundation now as well, which is a great, they have a great patient resource as well. So people could be sent there if you want to reinforce some messages that you're sharing in the clinic. There's just free 1-minute modules. I think there's like 16 or 17 of them, which are great modules for people who are living with pain. I'm hoping we'll have some information up on the IASP task force soon. And I'll share that on Twitter, and I'll tag you when I do. And and through that task force, we're going to be developing materials about what this like co-production or co-creation or patient partnering can look like. So I'm hoping will be a really rich resource bank as we develop it. And the task force itself is comprised of people with lived experience and with traditional IASP membership, which is researchers and healthcare professionals. So I'm really excited for.
Yeah, it's an exciting project. I think you could really lead the light on that partnership model that we were talking about. It needs to be appropriately tested and stop these sort of, you know, it's a better step in the right direction, but those sort of tokenistic filters, as I described them earlier, where it's like, yeah, that's better than nothing, but fundamentally that's just a nod to it rather than a true integration. So I look forward to you putting that to the test. It's exciting for all of us. Thank you for doing that work.
Thank you. I'm excited and daunted.
Yeah, I bet. It's intimidating. I can imagine. Obviously, yeah. And if at any time, if us as a team or the listeners, of course, need to get involved, or you want anything being shared widely, then get in touch. I know that everyone, you've been a frequently requested guest, as you were a frequently requested speaker at the event that you came and spoke at. So I know that the listeners are going to really have appreciated your honesty as ever on this conversation. But also, if ever you want to call upon them as a community of people to share their stories, then I'm sure that they'll be ready and waiting for you to do so. So thanks again for all that you do.
Thank you so much, Jack. And I'm going to take you up on that as we move forward as well.
Good. No, that's brilliant. Lovely. Well, take care. And we'll speak soon, no doubt.
Okay.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.